Yeah. We love the little ones in here. If you guys do feel like you need to leave, please feel free to go in the children's room. Either way is fine. So we are actually in a series of Genesis. We're in our third week. And I watched a video this week in one of my classes. I'm not going to show you to you. It was actually a very interesting documentary. But we had to watch this documentary about this really small French town called Le Chambon. And it was about World War II, where these people, there were only 5,000 people in this small French Alp town, and they housed and saved 5,000 Jews during the time of World War II. And this was not really something that was well known until recently, and it only came out because the people who were saved, the Jewish people at the time, they started speaking out about how these people had saved them. And you might think, you know, with 5,000 people being saved, that this was some, like, well-coordinated, organized effort to rescue Jewish people. But in actuality, when they did this documentary, one of the townspersons, whenever they were asked, you know, how did you guys organize this and place everybody and hide everybody? And she said something like this: oh, there was no organization. If there would have been, I don't think it would have worked. We did what any human being would have done for another. It was very simple. They needed a place to stay. We had a place. And so these people would just come in on trains at night in the middle of the dark, sometimes in the middle of the day, and just show up in town. And one townsperson would see them wandering around, knowing they're a stranger because it's such a small town, they knew everybody, and they'd say, hey, you need a place to stay? And they'd just go and stay in each person's house. And what was it, though, about this small town in France? Because the heart of Christian Europe at that time was Germany. Let that sink in for a minute. The heart of Christian Europe at that time was Germany. That's where the most theologians lived. That's where the biggest churches were. And yet this small Protestant town in France is where 5,000 Jews were saved. And in Germany, where thousands, millions were slaughtered and denied sanctuary. And so in the coldness that existed towards the Jews, there was this town that provided a space when so many other Christians were afraid of the power that existed in the Third Reich. And in this, the documentary's conclusion was that these townspeople, it didn't focus on their faith necessarily. It focused on them being able to resist fear, resist pride, and resist hate by being by caring for others more than themselves, by being humble and being kind. But we see the echoes of the gospel all throughout that. That's exactly what Jesus taught us: not to be afraid of any man, but to only fear the Lord, who has power over our souls. And so the people of the town, they were the first to tell you, we are not perfect people. In fact, we had a fight out back last night. But they did what they could do, because Jesus said, what you do to the least of these, you do for me. And this has connection that we're going in Genesis today, because I tell you that as we look at the life of Noah today, he was like the people of Le Chambon, that when the world around them was in violence and chaos, they provided a space where people were safe. And so because he was a man with the same heart as the people of Le Chambon, so they were very simply doing what God commanded. It wasn't anything complicated. They didn't make it complicated. And I also tell you this story to inspire you, because it's inspired me in times in our country where we have seeing a lot of violence and strife between differing groups, that we would be people who would provide that space, even though it can be scary. Okay? So, just a quick summary of what we read. I like to think about Genesis in four movements, like the seasons. But my theory is it doesn't start in spring. It starts in summer. Because when God created everything, it was perfect. Full maturity, completion, it was perfect. And that was Eden. And so I've showed you guys this graphic before. This is where we started out with everything was perfectly arranged and organized. God had formed the spaces He had filled those spaces. He had established humanity over stewarding his creation, but he was ultimately in charge and at rest in perfect rule in the Garden of Eden. But when Adam and Eve made their choice to disobey God and sin entered as the master of our hearts, we decided that we'd just take God out of the picture and we'd establish our own reign over this good creation that God had made. We call this the fall. So that kind of goes well with my seasonal thing, right? From summer to the fall, okay? Easy way to remember. So we have in here that coolness blew in, death and decay became the order of the day. It began infecting the remnants of summer that were left. And that's what we've looked at in our first 2 weeks of Genesis. And this week, we move on to winter. There are hardly any remnants of summer to be found. Disorder, as you can tell, has moved to non-order. It's absolute anarchy as humans take full control of God's creation. And all of this is in the first 5 chapters of Genesis. We couldn't keep it together. We didn't have the authority or the power that God had to do that. But the good news is that spring is coming. And that's what the rest of the book that we call the Bible is about. Spring is coming. And it's coming into completion in what will be summer again, when we're all together with the Lord at the end. But I want us to remember that as we read today, that this story has a pattern and it has God's... We need to remember the overarching narrative, because if we don't, God's judgment that we read about today will seem arbitrary and unjust if we don't keep in mind the rescue plan that he has for humanity, who is created in his image. If we forget that God is the one who delayed judgment, because remember he said, Adam and Eve, you will certainly die if you eat of this tree. But God delayed that judgment because he is so good, and he needed one who was righteous enough and innocent enough to take away all the sins of the world. We just sang about it, that Jesus is the only one who could do that. And that is God's mercy and his goodness that informs even his judgment. Okay, so today we look at Noah for grown-ups, okay? I like to call it that because I thought about while I was writing, we've all heard the story of Noah countless times, right, as a kid. In fact, it's one of the kids' favorite Bible stories because it has all the animals, right, that come onto the ark. It's a beautiful thing. There's puppy dogs and rainbows, literally all in the same story, right? Which is great. It communicates God's love for people, God's love for animals and his creation, how he wants them to be safe and secure, and that when God makes a promise, he keeps it. And nothing wrong with any of that. But Noah for Grownups is a bit more of a nuanced biography. Noah for Grownups doesn't start out with Noah building a boat. Noah for Grownups starts out with the world in this area. This is this is the kids' Noah. I had that picture, I forgot to show you guys. This is Noah for kids. But we're going to hear about Noah for Grownups, right? So this is a real place in a real time that actually happened. We've been dealing with these three areas. Mesopotamia, this is where Babylon, they think the Garden of Eden was between here. Mesopotamia means between the rivers, so the Tigris and the Euphrates. Abraham, we're going to read about him next week, started out up here. Canaan, the land of Canaan, which is what we now know as Israel or Palestine. And then Egypt over here. Those are our three big land masses that we deal with in the book of Genesis. And Mesopotamia at this time was in absolute chaos in the time of Noah, with the exception of one man and his family. So chapter 5 in Genesis tells us the lineage from Adam to Noah, and you'll notice that the people lived a lot longer than anybody else in these days. You guys have noticed that, hundreds of years. And there are actually several different theories about that. I'll address that just real quick. Ranging from the theory that those who were closest to Adam and Eve had a remnant, kind of like I was talking about, of Eden, that allowed them to live longer because they were made to live longer, and that kind of hung around for several generations. They could have counted the years differently then. because of them not yet understanding astronomy. I was going to say astrology. That's not what we're talking about. Astronomy. And but they also think that some of the numbers could have been symbolic, because Enoch lived for 365 years, which would mean a complete year. In other words, it could just mean that he had a complete life. So there are several different theories out there about, you know, people living this long. But we're quite sure, however, that even if you don't agree with however many years that people live, that the genealogies in the Bible don't capture every person who lived in every generation. We know that from Jewish historians. But they give the backbone and the true structure of what actually happened through the generations. We're absolutely sure of that. And after the genealogy list in chapter 5, we're given more insight into what the generations have done. So we're going to start reading at Genesis chapter 6, 1 through 22. You can join with me in your Bibles. I'll also have it on the screen. You can also pull it up on your phone if you'd like to read along. Genesis chapter 6, 1 through 22. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years." The Nephilim were on earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Okay, we need to pause, because who are these sons of God and these daughters of men? And then we have these Nephilim people, which, you know, interesting term there, because that term in Hebrew means fallen ones. Like, there's a definite negative connotation to this name. So most scholars believe that the sons of God, because this phrase is used in Deuteronomy, Psalms, Isaiah, Hosea, Luke, and 1 John, are actually godly men. Men who believed in the Lord, that these were called the sons of God. And it could even be referencing the kings of old, like just people who were kings, who were also aligned with God. And they believe that the daughters of men are women from Cain's line. So these would be considered ungodly women. In other words, men marrying women outside of the line. We kind of see this too in Israel's future that we'll get to soon, that they marry outside of the lineage of God. And so their offspring, the Nephilim, were fallen in the sense that godly people had intermingled with ungodly. There's another theory out there, though, is that these other people, these sons of God, were actually angels, fallen angels, demons, in other words, that married with human women. That is one of the theories out there. I myself prefer the first theory, because I don't see any evidence of angelic human relationship outside of this passage through the whole arch of scripture. But sons of God is more often used to refer to godly men or kings in the Old Testament. So we also see in this passage that God looks to be limiting the number of days. Their days will be numbered to 120 years. But that could also be that God is delaying judgment for 120 years. People can see that both ways in the Hebrew. But we kind of see that, though. I actually just read this morning in the news that a person who was 117, the oldest person alive today, was 117, and it just passed away. So it is interesting that, you know, that 120-year age mark, we haven't really gone past that as humans. But I don't think that this verse exceptionally or like eliminates that possibility at all. So let's keep reading. I actually had a terrible joke. I was like, there's not a deadline. Get it? With 120 years. Pun intended. All right. Sorry. That was a bad joke. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil at the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, "I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. And Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so we see things have gotten so bad that God is bringing impending judgment. Increasingly, humans see God as their enemy instead of as their father. None of them listen to guidance. Violence and wickedness are prevailing. But Noah found favor because he was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. Now, righteous is not a word that we use too often in like our typical everyday speech outside of the church. I actually heard it recently in Finding Dory, whenever the turtle, he's like a surfer turtle, and he says, righteous, right? You know, like the surfer guys. But the word simply means morally upright or of excellent virtue. So whenever you hear that, you can think of morally upright, excellent, or virtuous. It isn't just somebody who does good things. It is somebody who is truly at their heart a good person, and they can't help but do good things out of that goodness. And so this does not imply that Noah was sinless. He was not sinless. We're going to read about that in a little while. But unless he had been walking with God, that's the only way he could have been considered blameless and righteous and morally upright. Noah wasn't perfect, but he believed God and he obeyed him, even when everybody else around him did not. So again, we see God's goodness in preserving the human race, even though he had every right to obliterate us. The story doesn't end here in the winter, though, because God has planted a seed of hope in Noah's family. And it's in his son Shem, to be exact, for reasons we're going to learn soon. But let's keep reading. Verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. And the word ark here is actually used in several places in the Old Testament. And it means like a container to carry something. We see it with Moses in the basket that's pushed out, the Ark of the Covenant. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. This is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. Make a roof for it, leaving below the roof an opening 1 cubit high all around. Put a door in the side of the ark and make lower, middle, and upper decks. I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens, every creature that has breath of life in it. I don't know if you guys have seen it. They've made a replication of the ark. I think it's up in Ohio. So if you ever want to see what it really looked like, you can go visit. But it's a really cool recreation. And remember what I was saying about if we don't keep in mind how good God is, we can read some of these verses and think, God is horrible. He's terrible. He's destroying everything that he created, but we have to keep it in the context. Everything on earth will perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, Noah, and you will enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal, and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for them. Noah did everything just as God commanded him. The grown-up story of Noah doesn't sugarcoat it. God is enacting judgment. Even though he has delayed it, he's doing this because people have heaped abuse on themselves, on each other, and on God's creation. And I am convinced that God only does good things because he is good. So it must be pretty bad when God looks around on the earth and says the only way to fix this is to wipe it clean. This was the dead of winter in terms of humanity. And there was only one little flame flickering in the darkness, Noah. And God even allowed him to bring his family with him. Did you notice that? It doesn't say that Noah's family was righteous and upright. We don't know anything about them, actually. Well, we will, actually, in a little bit. But have you felt this moment in your life, though, where all hope feels, and looks lost. By any calculation you could fathom, things can't get better. I know friends, family members who have reached this moment and chosen to die instead of to face the next day. The evil of this world, the injustice of this world, the seeming pointlessness of this world, the failure after failure after failure, even though you're pouring everything into it, is overwhelming. In fact, that I am certain that without God, none of us would have made it this far in our lives. This is why Noah is a grown-up story. Because when Noah looked out at everyone else around him, there was no help and there was no hope. In fact, because they were so violent, I could imagine Noah being a victim of that violence. There was literally no visible reason for Noah to be any other way than the rest of the world. No other visible reason, except that Noah walked with an invisible God. He could do things that other people couldn't do, like hope. He was free to choose the right way of doing things. And not only did he listen to God, but he obeyed God. That's something no one else on earth could do at the time. And it didn't matter what anybody else said or did to him, because Noah's hope wasn't in humans. It was in the Lord. I pray that we would take this into our own lives when people let us down, or when they take advantage of us, or commit violence against us. I hope that we remember to walk with God through it all, because he's the only one who can show us the way through the deep waters. And it is a narrow way that only he knows. So we come to the part in the story that the kids focus on, right? Noah, all the animals come to him, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but I want to point out three things that we normally don't see from the children's story. God was actively intervening to save humanity from themselves. Though Noah faithfully built the ark, God was the one who tamed the animals to come to Noah and his family. And by the way, there was one pair of unclean animals, and there were actually, we read in the chapters, seven pairs of clean animals. So there were actually there were more pairs of clean animals. God was also the only one who closes the ark from the outside, who brings the deluge. So in other words, he's not a distant God. Even in this time of violence and chaos in the earth, he is not separated from what is happening. Number two, most people think that they only spent 40 days in the ark, but they actually spent over a year. There's different estimates. 1 year, 17 days. 1 year, 70 days. I've seen a lot of different things, but it was definitely over a year that they were in the ark as the waters came up. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, but then they remained in the boat for longer. There's also been a lot of debate over whether the flood only covered the Mesopotamian region that I showed you, where humans lived at the time. We know that this Fertile Crescent in Africa, or the cradle of humanity is what they call it. So did it only cover that area, or did it cover the entire earth? The Hebrew actually is a little bit, it could be read either way. And because of the way that they thought about the world, we talked about that the first week, they saw the world as like this flat place with waters above and waters below. And so we aren't 100% sure, but it makes sense to me that it would be a global flood. As I read the scripture. And it also makes sense from genetic studies that we've done. Our ancestral gene pool is very small. Scientific genetic studies have shown this. In fact, all living humans are descended from two identified branches of DNA, which I find very interesting, considering Noah and his wife are on that boat. Which scientists have actually also calculated to mean that if we take my DNA and compare it to somebody like, say, who lives in China, that, and by the way, I have absolutely no Asian American genetic history, we will be cousins at some point in our ancestry. So on average, we're about 50th cousins with anybody that we meet on Earth. So look around. We've been kissing cousins for a long time. Now, this is not my promotion of inbreeding, right? But it is to say that we are all related in some fashion. It's why we as a human race feel this connection with each other that can't be explained, and that we are far more connected than some of us would like to believe. One race is not better than the other. One ethnicity is not inferior to another. We are all from the same stock, biblically and scientifically proven. So, returning to the biblical account, simply listening to the children's version, we miss out on the fact that there's a beautiful mirroring that occurs in the Hebrew in chapters 8 and 9. One commentary says it this way: Genesis 1 describes the original beginning, while 8 and 9 describe a new beginning after the flood in the same literary order. It's a really beautiful mirroring. I challenge you to read that those two chapters this week, just reading between them to see the commonalities. God had brought spring to the earth. And to confirm his commitment, God reestablishes this washed creation by the floodwaters and makes a covenant with Noah that we're getting ready to read. You're going to hear echoes, though, of the covenant that he made with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And by the way, a covenant is just a legal and binding contract, if you want to call it that, between two or more people that have conditions attached to it. I will do this if you will do this. Remember, Adam and Eve had vocation, permission, and prohibition in their covenant. You would work the land. You can eat from anything in the tree. You are not to eat from one tree. So vocation, permission, prohibition. So again, we see God employ this pattern of covenant after they come out of the ark. So let's read together again Genesis 9, 1 through 17. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." Remember, echoes of Genesis 1 and 2 right there. "The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground and on all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you." Now, this is a little bit different. Garden of Eden, they were said every green plant is given for you to eat. Now God is expanding this in this creation. "Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind." So we see God beginning to establish a rule of law that whenever somebody is killed, that there has to be an accounting made for that, which has already existed, but he's letting human beings in on this knowledge. "As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, 'I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth.' And God said, 'This is the covenant. This is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth.' So God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth.'" So you can see here, God's repeating it. "This is my covenant. I am establishing this covenant. I will make this promise." And this was a good day because God had restored order to the earth, though it was through death. hinting at a theme that we're going to see a lot through the Bible: life through death. God preserved a remnant who was faithful to him. And this is what I love about God. He not only makes a promise, but he gives a sign that confirms it for all generations in the form of a rainbow. By the way, that word bow in the Hebrew literally means bow, like a bow and arrow, shaped like a bow. What's interesting is that if you think about a rainbow and its shape, where is the bow aimed? Upward, towards God. As if, and this is called a self-maledictory oath in covenant language, that's just a fancy word for saying, if I break my part of the covenant, then I am the one who will suffer the punishment. And we're going to see, obviously, later in the New Testament that even when we are the ones who have broken covenant, God is the one who will take the punishment. This is the God that we serve. And we see also, not only do we see rainbows after storms still to this day, reminding of us of God's promise, there has not been a global flood that has destroyed humanity since this time. These words were written thousands of years ago. There's no way the author of Genesis could have known this outside, obviously, of God's inspiration. So those are two things that we know that have not been broken that God has promised. Now, us as humans, not so much, right? We saw in the conditions that God just gave. Even this righteous, blameless, upright man, Noah, who God had given all this to, who had witnessed God's miraculous intervention firsthand, has a weakness. And at the end of chapter 9, we find out Noah plants a vineyard, makes some wine, which isn't wrong in itself, but then gets drunk, so drunk that he passes out naked in his tent. Noah for grown-ups. You're not going to hear that in any children's sermon anytime soon, okay? One of Noah's sons, Ham is his name, he walks into the tent and sees Noah naked. And he goes back out of the tent instead of covering up his dad. And he heads out and he tells his other two brothers. I'm not going to imagine what that scenario was like. But he goes and tells his other two brothers, Shem and Japheth, they actually back into the tent with a blanket so they don't see their father's nakedness, and they cover him up as he's passed out drunk. And instead of broadcasting their father's nakedness like Ham had done, Shem and Japheth cover their father's nakedness. And I won't delve too deeply here, but this act has a lot to say about what our loving action should be when it comes to nakedness and exploitation of people who are not in their proper senses. Our entire entertainment industry, which literally broadcasts nakedness and exploitation right into our homes and our phones, is built on this. We rationalize the viewing of this by saying that it's not hurting anyone, but it does so in so many ways because it objectifies the image of God that we were created in. Nakedness in itself is not bad. Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. We were made beautiful to admire each other. The problem enters whenever we exploit that. When we derive erotic pleasure outside of the bounds of marriage which God gave between a man and a woman. Our nakedness is only to be shared in a covenant relationship that God has established for our pleasure and for our safety in this fallen world. We're told in heaven we won't need marriage. But it's the safe place that God has given us in the here and now that reflects the way that Jesus loves his church and the church loves Jesus. And we go so wrong in this area in America in so many ways. Our sexual revolution that was meant to be very freeing has enslaved us in ways that we aren't even aware. But I digress. Let's get back to the story. Because due to this act, Ham, who is the father of Canaan, you'll remember the land that we showed, Noah curses his lineage. And Canaan sounds familiar because these are the people living in the land when Israel comes to take the promised land. We'll read about them, all the Ites, the Jebusites, Hittites, Amorites, right? they will one day conquer these Canaanite peoples who are noted in the Bible as being exceptionally wicked and sinful, who worship a multitude of other gods. And this was a father's condemnation of his child's immoral behavior. And it looks like a generational curse that continues through the decades. Now, chapter 10 details the ancestral lines. We're not going to read through all of that. Of Noah's sons, how the world was repopulated. And we're told in verse 32, from these the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. And our last section this week is very shortly the Tower of Babel. It's a short encounter where the people again try to make their way to heaven, make their own rules to achieve perfection, and this time they try to build a tower. They're like, okay, let's all work together and we'll build a tower to heaven so that way we can get to heaven and we can achieve greatness. Again, we see people denying their God-given identity as the children of God and trying to establish themselves. And where God delivered judgment in the flood, this time God restrains the ambition of the people by scattering them and confusing their language. And what's interesting about this story is that we have linguistic evidence of an original language that was used around 3000 BC. Linguistic studies have shown this, but then after that point, it explodes into what we now have around the world, 5,000 different languages on the earth as of today. Or maybe not as of today, but you know, around about this time, whenever they did the study. So, even in this season of spring, where God has established a new covenant, people are still wanting to do their own thing. They're still going their own way, ignoring God, but God is sticking to his promises. And I've told you that this is a theme we're going to see all throughout Genesis, that whenever I used to read it, I used to think it was about the characters and the people, and I was learning from them, and instead of actually taking a step back and realizing, this isn't about the people, this is about God, and the way that he is intervening in these people's lives, even though they continue to insist on death, he insists on life. And so next week, we get to see God draw even closer to humanity, though we have pushed him away. And as we close today, I hope you're beginning to catch a vision of God's real character. For you and me today, that these are real people whose lives he interacted with, and he is not a God who changes. He still does that today with us if we are walking with him, if we are obeying him and listening to him. And so my question for you this morning is, as you begin to wrestle with who God is and what he's like, I pray that you would actually catch a vision of himself from the book that he inspired. Because sometimes we can make up our own versions of God in our head. We can make him too angry, too safe, too harsh, too weak. But that's the beautiful part of Genesis to me. We don't get to say who God is. He's telling us who he is and showing us who he is. And sometimes we're going to read those things and it's going to make us feel uncomfortable, and it should, because he is not a God who can be put in a box or captured or tamed. And those parts that we don't like about him, those parts we might be afraid of, those parts that we might actually hate at some level in our being, he's putting them on display because he has nothing to hide. He is so righteous and so good. He has nothing to hide. In fact, he's an open book. So how can we judge anything that he does? If anything, whenever we feel that tension between how we don't like something that God is revealing about himself, we need to be the ones who are humbling ourselves and saying, you know what, God, I don't understand this, but I'm going to trust you because I don't understand this, because I know that you are the good one and I am the one who has gone wrong. And in fact, this is evidence for me that I serve a real, dynamic, and living God, not some made-up creation in my imagination. I always tell people that whenever I pray and he asks me to do something, they're like, how do you know it's him? I'm like, well, it's because I'd never come up with it myself. I would never come up with some of the things that God has asked me to do myself. And so he wants the same for each of us. Remember Noah. Remember the people of Les Chambons. And our foundational truth for today is Psalm 16:8. I keep my eyes always on the Lord. With him at my right hand, I will not be shaken. And I believe that's exactly what Noah did. And I'd like to ask Eddie if he'll close us in prayer today.